Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now I'm joined by Michael Eric Dyson, the Georgetown sociology professor, New York Times contributing opinion writer and author. Michael Eric Dyson has appeared on the show many times to offer social analysis and scholarly reflections on race. Today, we might say he's here to preach, maybe a little like in his role as an ordained minister over the past 35 years, to preach to white people, you might say, in the context of his latest book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Michael Eric Dyson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, my friend. Always great to be here.
So in the book, you write about what you call the five stages of white racial grief. Mm-hmm. What are the five stages of white racial grief?
Let me see if I can remember them. So they include a denial of fact, that pretending it never happened. And then there is another kind of denial that says, yeah, it happened, but not the way you said it. There's appropriation. If you can't beat them, kind of join them. There's a way of rewriting the history itself so that, you know, you write yourself into a kind of heroic stance. So what I'm trying to get at here is the way in which white grief has evolved in the face of opposition and being called to account both as a specific racial identity among the family of ethnicities and races, and then secondly, of trying to get rid of some of that white innocence and that white fragility and that white vulnerability and come to grips in a rather robust fashion with what it means to be white.
So when you say the denial of it or the appropriation of it, mm-hmm. are you talking about white supremacy as a large concept? Are you talking about slavery and discrimination in particular? What's it?
Yes. So
and yes, so, and yes.
Yeah, yep, and some more. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Although, you know, you say white supremacy, and, you know, I tried to write this book in a way, I mentioned that in the book, but for the most part, I try to give a more poetic description, a more fluid analysis of what's happening. And the appropriated reality is blackness itself. The very despised thing that whiteness has cast aspersion on has been absorbed and circulated in white culture. And the it that it is afraid of is the kind of self, the black self, the denied self, the suppressed self that comes to dinner, not as a maid or a butler, but as a co-participant in the banquet of American citizenry. And that kind of resentment is pretty palpable. And what I wanted to do is to talk about what it means to be white in those ways, not just the traditional ways that we're used to hearing about it.
Talk more about the idea of appropriation. Usually when we hear that word these days, it has to do with cultural appropriation, mm-hmm. like maybe white authors writing black people's stories, taking black characters' roles.
Yes, that's right.
You mean it in a larger sense?
Yeah, I mean it that way too. I mean, that's important. But yeah, in the broader sense of, you know, appropriating those experiences and making them one's own, or appropriating the language. Think about it. You are black racist. You know, many white people that I know loved, especially conservatives, and maybe I'm just looking at my Twitter feed, just love to call me and others who insist upon white culpability and responsibility, you're a black racist. And I try to clarify, look, black people can be a lot of things. They can be prejudiced. They can be bigoted. They can be horribly, violently, you know, resistant to another. But racism is a kind of specific and scientific term. That means that you have the power to impose your will on the broader society, to make law, custom, and habit, and tradition at your beck and call, and to be capricious about exercising your power. Black people don't have racist power in that sense, even though they can be horribly bigoted and woefully prejudiced. So when white people appropriate those terms to shoot back at black people, they're misunderstanding history.
This is an old conversation that we've been having. I don't mean you and me. I mean society's been having for decades.
Right.
The definition of racism.
Right.
So you're saying it's not just holding your race up as superior to others, which is how a lot of people might think of racism, especially a lot of white people. You're saying you have to hold your race up as superior and have the power to enforce that in a way that disadvantages others.
Right, because you could be a 5'2" guy saying, you know, I'm better than any ball player ever. Oh, okay. Yeah. So LeBron has something to say about that. But if you have the power to be 6'9", and you can play basketball, and you can impose your will, then you've got a different thing. Yeah, power is a big element to it there.
Your book has been referred to as scathing by some in the way it seeks to implore white people to renounce myths of white supremacy. You write in the book, for example, it's hard to be white and empathetic to others. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's out of context. Sounds like a very broad brush.
Right, right.
How much are you trying to inspire? How much are you trying to shame white people into looking at the world differently?
I just want white people to look into the mirror. And white people have interesting responses. And I know it's hard to be white because white people say, well, I can't win at all. Well, welcome to the world that you created in which black and brown people have operated. White people are complaining about the very cages they have constructed. And when it's applied to them, it's a big deal. Oh, my God, it's so unfair to paint with such a broad brush. When I say white America, it's a trope. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphysical articulation about the possibility of group identity, behavior, and solidarity. So welcome white people to the world you create and inhabit. Welcome to the world that you imposed upon people of color every day. And now you want us to be empathetic and sympathetic to you. And we are. God bless you. Fannie Lou Hamer said, the problem with white people is that they dominated black people. They put us behind them. Therefore, we had to learn everything about white people in order to survive. White people had to learn nothing about people of color in order to live. So now white people have to be introduced, and they're resentful, they're hollering. That's why Donald Trump is the perfect exemplar of this white age of innocence. It's the first toddler presidency. When you're spewing and muking and puking and all, you know, pooping in your diaper and wanting to spread it around, this is the insistence that whiteness be exempt from critique. And Donald Trump spent 2 years of his life castigating the presidency of the officially established and enshrined and duly elected president of the United States of America, Barack Obama, as illegitimate, and a black congressman who was also an icon of the civil rights movement calls him illegitimate and he loses his lunch. This is what whiteness means if you want to see it in picture.
Listeners, who wants to talk to Michael Eric Dyson? White listeners especially encouraged to apply. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In response to this conversation about his book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, 212-433-9692. I've been thinking about the election in the context of how the narrative of change seemed to be going in one direction, and it suddenly got flipped on its back.
Right.
So a few months ago, we were talking about issues raised by Black Lives Matter, issues raised by Ta-Nehisi Coates when he writes about reparations, issues raised by all around criminal justice reform, for example. Now, and that's not to say, you know, that everybody agrees on every position of each of those things. But now the conversation is turned on its head. Now it's about law and order. Now it's about those disenfranchised white working class people who are being ignored by the Democratic Party.
Whiteness will triumph. Whiteness will have its way, even if the conversation is about what it should be about, how we are complicit in the horrors and tragedies of police brutality. All of a sudden, the subject returns to whiteness. No, it's about the white working class. Isn't that interesting? Nobody cared about the white working class. Let's be honest. Even the present president doesn't speak much about poverty. No, you know, none of the presidential candidates, except with the exception of Bernie Sanders. And even there, it was a kind of tone deaf articulation about class consciousness because it didn't figure into the consideration black and brown working class people as well. So now a white working class is supposed to be the basis of American revenge. Dude, first of all, Donald Trump lost the election by nearly 3 million people. Where's the populism? You know, where's the beef? Where's the populism? Number two, he was advantaged by, benefited by demographic destiny and geographical mishap. And, you know, the capricious nature of our electoral college that awards prizes to people who, in some cases, don't deserve them. So my point is, ultimately, the white working class, there's a black working class. There's a brown working class. Why not speak about them? If we talk about this is the working class, no, that now must modify that adjective must modify that noun. White working class. This from people who say that they are interested in not in identity politics. Well, why are you calling it the white working class? Why? Because the reality is they were black and brown working class people who would never go for Donald Trump. And they were rural black and brown people who were not attracted to him. So what you're telling us is they don't matter. The working classes of anything but white people don't matter. That's why whiteness is the unifying factor of American life across axes of gender, race, and class.
Then why didn't more black and brown people go for Bernie Sanders? He was trying to lay out this unified class-based vision of change that I think he hoped would unify the so-called white working class and black and brown working class.
But in order,
and
to
it didn't work.
It didn't work because he didn't address them as the white working class. It didn't work because he doesn't deal with race very specifically, and shall we say rather awkwardly, but not with great grace. Let me say something probably controversial. Bernie Sanders is the left wing version of the right wing Donald Trump, a white guy of tremendous power, intelligence, and charisma. Although Bernie Sanders, far smarter, far more charismatic in terms of his ideas, but tone deaf when it comes to race. He wants to subsume race under class. He wants to make it an extension of class warfare. That big story that Derek Bell told on the panel once, when the communists came to Harlem, we have not paid attention sufficiently to the way in which the getting rid of identity politics that Bernie Sanders is heralding is what whiteness always wants to do. It wants to get rid of the specific formation of problematic racial identity in deference to a broader and bigger and therefore superior class formation. Race makes class hurt more, and he didn't get that point.
Michael Eric Dyson will take your phone calls for him. His new book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And Tina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Tina.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. There's a lot of really valid points that your speaker is addressing, and I don't mean to invalidate them, but I think that you create so many difficulties in accepting some of the salient points by painting very, very, painting us all into corners that you don't allow any getting out of. If you can criticize somebody like Bernie Sanders that heavily, then there are just no solutions, and let's just go, you know, sit in the dark someplace and do nothing. Mm. And when you can define racism so specifically and so make it so, isn't the point what the sentiment that people were using the term when didn't include the speaker's definition? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a definition, but not the widely accepted one. So, like, just address the sentiments and not get all caught up in the semantic when you can say white America and now suddenly you get to have this metaphorical breath, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point, but stay with me. Look at the resentment that you have, rightfully so, about the semantic and substantive differences, and then calling into question rather what you would think clumsy articulations that span a range of people. First of all, would you admit that that has, quote, happened? You would, of course, on, quote, the other side, that is, black and brown people have been subject to that. But secondly, how do we get a handle on the way in which many white brothers and sisters, now we can be even more specific, we can say maybe 37% of white people feel this, or 49.2% of white people feel this. White America is a handle that I can understand white Americans being resentful of, but if you're a white person and that's the thing you're most resentful of, as opposed to the injustice that to which it points, as opposed to the underlying problems that we all confront, then I would throw the ball back in your court and say, wait a minute now, you're being a bit too invested in and possessive of a kind of rhetorical gesture that makes critical distinctions, which are important, but the ultimate truth of the underlying suffering that people are enduring is far more important. So when women come to me as a man and say, you know, what you men have done, and I could go, wait a minute, not all men have done that. There have been some feminists who have been involved as progressive, insightful figures who have resisted. But as a man, I've got to take that lash. I've got to know that many men have done the wrong thing, have participated in a patriarchal, misogynistic, sexist culture, and I'm not going to focus on a feminist who's been hypercritical and sensitive to my own nomenclature as opposed to the undergirding sexism that continues to rule the lives and sexual violence to which women are subject. So I would ask you to back up off of, dare I say, a form of white privilege and ask a deeper question and think more strategically, because you and I are on the same side. I can tell we're going to be friends for life.
Tina, you want to keep going?
No, I think that you're just creating more divides than than closing them. I think what it's just so divisive, this kind of
But
semantics when I'm criticizing that
right.
one particular thing. But
right.
again, I agree with you can't paint all men who are misogynists with the same brush. But of course, men try to own it. They try to make
yes.
changes. And same with white people in very general terms.
I get it, but there's the white people who want
it, you know?
It's the white people. May I say this, Tina? Because you're my friend now, like you. Who call into the show intelligently and articulately, and you are not helping us deconstruct the vicious animus directed toward Obama for the last 8 years. You're not talking about the horrors that you no doubt see in some of your Thanksgiving dinners when some of your aunts and uncles are using horrible words or some people that you know whose aunts and uncles are.
Well, what do you know about that?
I
haven't spoken about any of that, and this isn't my forum.
That's what I'm saying to you. There are many white people whose aunts and uncles at Thanksgiving dinner do it. You don't have to be the specific person. If the shoe fits, wear it. And I'm saying you're being defensive about protecting a certain kind of whiteness that to me is part of the problem.
She's reacting to how you're presenting.
I understand that, but I'm saying, and I'm reacting to the fact that Martin Luther King Jr. said the real problem is not the KKK, it's the moderate right liberal who refuses to interrogate the depth of their privilege. And I'm asking, Tina, into a broader conversation to be a bit more uncomfortable, to go outside of your box, to think more critically and self-critically about what you are saying and that what I'm saying, and then together let's fashion a different future. If I can't be critical of Bernie Sanders because I think that it's easy to paint Donald Trump as the bigot, but it's harder to say maybe some things that Bernie Sanders is doing that are problematic that preclude the possibility of real transformation. I just want you to hear me at least on that, man.
Tina, we're not going to solve it today.
But Tina, thanks for calling,
dialogue.
Though.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute with Michael Eric Dyson. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Georgetown sociology professor Michael Eric Dyson. His new book, Tears, We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And let me just ask you, we don't even have that much time left. How are you feeling and what are you thinking about President Obama and his legacy? You don't know all the categories in our bracket, but in these final days of his presidency, you've sometimes been a supporter and sometimes a critic on these airwaves.
Yeah, well, this past Sunday I had the cover story on in the Weekend Review on Sunday, and I talked about how Black America collectively held its breath as Barack Obama proceeded through those years, his paces, his gestures, wondering if the society was going to let him live long enough to do his job. And so let's be honest, whatever criticisms we have, whatever, you know, critiques we might offer, we're sorry to see that man leave, because we've got a guy who can give an interview to the New York Times and Michiko Kakatani and talk about the books that have shaped him. And what is Donald Trump going to talk about? The tweets that have made him? I mean, the literacy of this outgoing president makes us nostalgic already. He saved the automobile industry. He gave us universal health care, which will not be easily, I think, rejected. He gave us a sound economic standing. This economy has been in far better shape because of him. Despite vicious opposition and rancid racist reaction, the man has stood the test of his own time, and I think will go down as one of the best presidents we've had, and the most cerebral among the top three, maybe Lincoln, Jefferson, and Obama.
Katrina in Jersey, you're on WNYC with Michael Eric Dyson. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for this program. I think it's wonderful. It's a good discussion to be having. I just want to say that in caring about seeing change, I'd ask, how can white America promote change?
Yes, ma'am. Oh, that's a great question. I talk about it in my book. I end with a section called The Benediction, because my book is structured like a sermon. And I talk there about several things that white Americans can do. I said, first of all, you know, we've had this big debate about reparations. I say, look, you can have big social change like reparations, but you can have individual reparations, that things that individual white brothers and sisters can do. Take a kid to the neighborhood gallery, introduce them to art. If you got a person cutting your lawn, pay them a little bit more than you'd pay ordinarily. Those are things. And then educate yourself about these issues. Read a person like a Tim Wise or a Mab Sigrist or a Peggy McIntosh on white privilege. Or then talk about white brothers and sisters tweeting out on social media their understanding that, hey, we got away with a lot of stuff that people of color don't, and we know it's unfair. So there are so many things that ordinary, average white brothers and sisters can do. And I think the most important thing is, and I was trying to say this to the last caller, is that around that Thanksgiving table, say things that black people, brown people will never have access to those tables to say, and challenge, not nastily, not viciously, but persistently, some of the ignorance that you hear coming from them, and challenge some of the misinterpretations and stereotypes that might prevail. These are some of the things that I think white brothers and sisters can do to make the situation better.
Katrina.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. On Obama, we had this clip pulled, but we don't even have time to play it before we run out of time. But, you know, he said in his farewell address, trying to tie everybody together to understand each other better, he said, for blacks and other minorities, it means tying our own struggles for justice to the challenges that a lot of people in this country face, the refugee, the immigrant, the rural poor, the transgender American, and also the middle-aged white man who from outside may seem like he's got all the advantages, but who's seen his world upended by economic, cultural, and technological change.
So all of you women who are struggling against misogyny, understand those men whose lives are difficult too, and how difficult it might be for them to come up with a feminist perspective. What? Come on. That's a false equivalence. We love the president. That's the reason he's been so successful. But one of the great failures of the presidency of Barack Obama has been to challenge, not nastily, not viciously, but even perceptibly, the perspectives of a dominant culture that doesn't want to confront the fact that it has certain privileges that it's not willing to acknowledge. And I think Obama reinforced them there. I think empathy is critical, but I think the empathy should flow from those who have historic legacies of power to those who don't.
Michael Eric Dyson, Georgetown sociology professor, his new book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir.